to participate in an overview of the corrections agency. Commissioner, you want to come to the seat opposite me, please? And this will be very informal. The Hess Committee still retains jurisdiction under the uniform rules. I think so much is happening so rapidly in corrections that if you could bring us back in a picture of where you are, it would be very helpful and just proceed in your own way. And then we'll ask questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator. I'm Roger Endow, Deputy Commissioner of the Adult Corrections Agency, and I thought that I might share with you some charts here and graphs and go over a few figures, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about our growth. Clearly, the greatest problem that we're faced with is a tremendous increase in the numbers of inmates statewide. In terms of history and the department, agency, and so on July 12, 1983, Governor Sheffield signed the Administrative Order Number 77, which separated adult corrections from the Department of Health and Social Services. And in fact, we are an autonomous agency now under that administrative order. Since then, well, at the same time, I suppose, House Bill 103, which would in effect create a new Department of Corrections, is still alive and before the legislature this session. In addition, there is an executive order, number 55, which would accomplish much the same thing. So we are hopeful that either the legislature and its actions would agree to pass House Bill 103, and I believe that's the governor's choice also. If not, then the Executive Order 55, as I understand it, might become effective about the 1st of March. Most critical issue, as I said earlier, is the steady rise in the inmate population. Most current projection based on figures for December of 82 through November of 83 reveals a projected increase of 32 inmates a month. It was, ironically, about 17 inmates a month were coming into our system before I took office. Well, Attorney General Will Condon reported 17 more inmates a month were coming into the system than were being released. Then it moved in February and March of last year to 25 people a month coming in more than were being released. And now it's 32, and there are indications that that's still rising. There's been a 26.5% increase in the inmate population just during calendar year 1983, resulting in 301 additional inmates. In other words, in very simple terms, we have 300 more inmates today, the end of January, than we had last year when I appeared before the legislature. It essentially means that should we have been able to construct a facility for 300 people, it would be full today. And if this trend continues, it has very serious economic implications for the state, which will force us to be as creative and innovative as we possibly can in order to properly house these inmates and protect the public and reform offenders.
Is that going to flatten out according to your projections, or would we always have an annual increment of 300 or more?
It appears to us that unless policy and law changes are made, that trend will continue and in fact may rise, because there are other additional laws which have been passed recently which are more restrictive. So not only are we getting more inmates coming to jail, but those who are coming are staying for longer periods. There's two patterns here evolving. Additionally, if I might turn to a chart, there's been some discussion among legislators and others about where this population increase is occurring, and it's clearly in the felony category. Approximately 15% of our inmates are misdemeanors, but clearly 85% and growing are the felony population. So this number reflects, slightly out of date. We now have about 1,700 inmates statewide, 200 of those being out of state with Federal Bureau of Prisons. There's another pattern that's evolving which is meaningful, and that is back here in 1974, and for a pattern for quite some time, there were clearly more people on probation and parole, the red line, than there were incarcerated. It has been about 2 to 1. Two people on probation and parole status for every person incarcerated. But clearly, as you see these lines evolve to the current status of institutions and field services people, we are not only catching probation and parole in terms of numbers, but we'll very soon surpass those numbers of people on probation and parole. Now, these are factual, as best we can make them, by interpreting our situation.
and they're really not disputable. We have a definite trend toward incarceration in this state. Alaska now has the honor, if you will, of being one of the highest, if not the highest, incarceration state. That is, our rate of incarceration is among the highest in all 50 states. And although in terms of actual numbers, 1,700 prisoners would easily fit into many county jails and some city jails. So the actual number is small, but the growth is tremendous. It's probably one of the highest in the nation. In terms of our overview of our organization, we very simply were not approved as a department last legislative session, but the legislature did see fit to fund the organization as though it were a department and gave us authority to go ahead and set up an executive management staff. This, very simply, is our structure. It's headed by a deputy commissioner, assisted by two assistant commissioners, one for administration, one for operations. Under operations, there are three regional directors, one for northern, south central, and the southeastern regions. And each of those regional directors has quite a list here of correctional centers and field services offices that they're responsible for. So this is our operational component, all institutions and field services.
Senator Wallace. Question, Mr. Nandale, right at this moment, how many of those are new positions that have come about in the past 12 months during this administration?
Last year, the legislature authorized us to hire 217 new personnel.
I'm talking about on this head shed lunch.
Well, it's a little difficult to answer, but we attempted to keep this under 12. In other words, we kept the organization as it formerly was in as a division of corrections and instituted a new executive management group. So we've done a great deal so that simply, well, where there would have been a director of corrections, that would have been one of these directors, which didn't exist then, which was elevated to deputy commissioner. Another one was elevated to each of these. So there were a lot of changes that were merely upgrades, not entirely new positions.
Well, I see nine positions there now. What number of, shall I call them, headshed administrators did we have before compared to what we have now doing the same thing? In other words, we had so many people running corrections this time last year, and we're proposing a new organization. Is it really necessary to have that many more heads?
Well, Senator and Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid it is. What we have here, one of the most difficult agencies in state government, in my opinion, to manage, and one of the reasons that corrections has been a mess for probably 20 years is because they've not been properly staffed to manage it. For example, our organization is about the same size as the Department of Public Safety, and they are properly organized, and they do have a fine management structure. We've not had that capability before, and that led to a host of the problems that existed. And we recommended to the governor in our task force report last December, January, a year ago, that this was a very serious problem which had to be looked at. What we attempted to do was do it we wanted the narrowest possible interpretation of the number of positions here.
Can you get us a list of the personnel who fill these leadership roles?
Yes, certainly.
And the fact that you're a deputy commissioner, so the commissioner, does that lead to compression of salaries at the top level? In other words, when the executive order takes effect, that will represent an increase in your pay, I assume.
I assume that it would be a commissioner level, so there would be some increase, yes.
You're very lackadaisical. I wouldn't be. Does that?
Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, there's not enough money to pay whoever has this job to do it well. So.
But would that also permit higher salaries for the assistant, for people now called assistant commissioners?
It could. These positions could rise to deputy commissioners, which seems to be rather traditional throughout state government. These positions are now directors at range 24, which is the lowest level director. They could conceivably rise to range 26. So there could be some lifting there, but that's something I hadn't dealt with at all. It could, I suppose the executive branch would have to approve it and the legislature fund it.
Now, just to put this in another perspective, if we continue on this track of adding several hundred people as inmates a year into the next decade, even after you have Seward, you will still need additional facilities every year, won't you? You won't be below capacity when Seward comes online.
That's true, Mr. Chairman.
I may be getting ahead of your story, and I don't need to do that. And what could we estimate a cost for 300 beds to be if we had to go out and do it as an annual exercise?
My guess, Mr. Chairman, would be somewhere in the mid-30s in terms of millions.
$30 million a year.
That would be just construction.
I ask this because we're going to have to find another way, and I think you agree with me.
Yes.
Senator Moss?
Just one other question. I noticed that in the report that we had on Alaskan correction issues of the 1980s by Eric Kopas, he alluded to the police organization's salary construction and noted that the correction range is meaningful lower. Beginning salaries are as much as $8,000 less. I guess the problem that I had when I looked at all of the added personnel there, are we going to correct that up to, when you alluded to the production people versus the correction people, are we going to be raising salaries as much as $8,000 in some cases and a number of people to bring it up to the same level of salary and so forth? It begins to worry me just a little bit, Mr. Chairman, that I'm beginning to see here, part of this report says there as much as $8,000 less. We're going to have 200 people that's going to, just bringing that salary up, that $8,000 they're talking about, to the public protections level is really scary.
Have you seen the Gary Kopas?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if you wouldn't mind, I have several comments relating to this report, but might I answer those a little later?
Okay, why don't we hold this off?
Okay, this is the only reason I ask these questions about this organization that you have here, because I begin to see some figures here that could go way out of reach.
Senator Moss, I think I can address that issue, though, and that is I don't have any intention at the present time, and I don't see any in the near future, of requesting upgrades for those personnel. It seems to me that our efforts, my job, is to make sure that we are adequately staffing our institutions for the safety of the employees, the inmates, and the public. So my priority is to make sure that we're adequately staffed. I don't see any upgrades in those salary levels for the near future.
Thank you.
Well, finally, in terms of this sort of chart and sort of an overview, and related to this part of the discussion, here we have a chart of the operating budget and staff comparison by fiscal year for fiscal year 83, 84, and 85. The dark blue representing the budget and the lighter blue representing the numbers of staff. And you can see clearly there is an upward trend. Now, I wish we were able to superimpose on this also the inmate increases. We may try to do that because it is also definitely an uphill trend. But clearly there has been large growth, and this represents this current year's request. We'll put our employees at about 1,000, assuming that our request is funded. The governor, I think, made it known that the $69 million budget that we are requesting this year, 69.7, is a substantial leap over last year. It's about 22%, I believe. That request is insufficient to accomplish the job that we have to accomplish. The difficulty here is that while it's clearly a growth pattern, it is not sufficient. There are some weaknesses in our present budget. For example, we were not approved for increased funds in the training area in spite of the fact that we're bringing on many new people. And we did not get our request for prison industries in spite of the fact that we want to put more inmates to work and they begin to return money to the state coffers, perhaps the victims, and the fact that prison industries is on sunset legislation, has to be self-supporting by 1987. So there are those sorts of difficulties. Clearly, there is an upward trend. However, it's all based on the number of inmates going into the system. Well, next, then, I'd just like to go quickly through this. What can we do about capital space? Well, the first things that we did, I was in office about 4 months, I believe, and we were able to successfully negotiate a contract for our surplus military property through the Kenai Natives Association at Wildwood. And in effect, when we were able to exercise our option to purchase that facility, we'll have a 200-bed plus facility for approximately $5 million with several outbuildings and other buildings. So it's a very economical acquisition. Secondly, we've managed to acquire from the Department of the Army the Goose Bay facility or site, which we intend to use for drunk drivers and minor offenders, and we can do that at a very, very low cost. We estimate that less than $1 million can be spent there on just building materials and using some inmate labor and some outside work. We'll have a facility that would hold 112 short-time people, very much less expensive than traditional construction. But new construction is inevitable because of the need to house high-security inmates and the fact that our quota is full with Federal Bureau of Prisons. What the contractors did here was do some comparisons in recent constructions at Palmer, Eagle River, Meadow Creek, Ketchikan, and Anchorage, showing in colors the costs of those kinds of housing and the security levels. And then they compared with this red line the cost estimates of the new construction that we have in mind. And there's a substantial difference, lower cost, in the new concept that we've been able to develop.
Before you leave that, I don't understand that drawing.
Medium security institution, for example, under our new proposal, which I'll be showing you shortly, would cost 193% less than the average cost of these three institutions, which, in other words, we paid out this level of money for Anchorage, Ketchikan, and Meadow Creek. If we were using this new design, we would have paid this amount of money.
Okay. So the Endel line is the economy line.
Yes.
Are you ready for office, Richard?
I didn't put my name in there. Unfortunately, someone else did.
All right. Senator Halford?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that the economy line, I think, looks like about $70,000 for medium security represents about three times what a fully paid Harvard education costs each year.
That may be correct. I think that probably we could take our entire prisoner population and send them to Harvard for less than it costs to house them in state in a jail facility. That's not difficult to prove. It's very expensive.
Well, this this is actual construction costs that you have built in the past these facilities on. Now, what does the purple mean?
This blue lady comment. This is the cost of a maximum security.
The new facility we're talking about.
No. This would be the, since we don't have a real maximum security facility, these are the cost estimates of the work done by my predecessor. In other words, the cost would, $160 million. We had determined that the Anchorage replacement facility and the long-term high security facility were going to cost a neighborhood of $91 million. And we now estimate that the Seward facility will be about $30 million less, which is a very substantial reduction.
Why?
Because of the design that we've come up with.
Okay, then it's strictly the design that you're coming up with.
Yes, sir.
Look at from
yes, the
now, the old estimates would have been the more conventional?
Yes, they're
traditional
construction methods and traditional prison design. The thing that is exciting, I guess, about what we've come up with here is that other states have gotten the word about what we've got on the drawing board, and they're interested in it. And that, I take as a compliment, and I think everyone is looking for solutions that are less costly, not only to build, but to operate. Well, perhaps I could move to the key here to the new design is the housing unit. And it's fairly easy for anyone, layman or other, to ascertain that a jail cell can be standardized. And the bunk can be standardized. It doesn't need to vary. So what we started with was the need for a jail cell that was in fact standardized and that could be built in a building that could be built anywhere from Barrow to Ketchikan. So what we have is a 112-foot square building that is 112 on each side. There are 32 cells around the bottom floor exterior of the building with day room space in front. The building is divided into four quarters with a control room in the middle. Now, the person in this control room can literally observe and control the movement of 64 people. That's 32 down and 32 upstairs. The building, though, is even the important aspect, and the reason that this is cost-saving, is it's essentially a post-and-beams building into which are slid prefabricated steel cells. These cells can be fabricated right here in-state. This little white box represents the utilities where the water controls, electrical, and so on are. They are simply plugged together into the master system. But this building, you would erect the posts and beams, slide in the steel units,
and they have a very comfortable, very durable Spartan home, which will be there for a very long time. Additionally, we wanted a jail housing design which could be used not only for the state correctional system, but for city jails. This building, for example, we proposed that one be built as a pretrial facility in Palmer. You can use half of this structure to house inmates. The other half could be used for police administration, could be used for courtroom space, be used for a variety of purposes. Instead of cells, make it into administrative space. Now these rooms are, I mean, this building is designed to be open. The control room is elevated 4.5 feet off the floor, so the control room operator looks down and up. If you wanted, you could divide these diagonally. For example, if we were to build one of these at Palmer or Kodiak or wherever, you could put pretrial women here, sentenced women here, maximum security men here, minimum security men here, and so on. You can also pour this floor, if you don't want it to be open, and have two separate floors within the facility. So it's a very flexible kind of design and much less costly than any other design that I'm aware of. This is the second floor.
One question. I thought we were using facilities at Wildwood and these other places that were already built. What I'm looking at here is we've got a complete new structure. Is that what we're talking about? Tear down the old structure and put it in. So the only thing we got out of Wildwood, and now that deal over there across the inlet, is going to be just the ground and maybe surface of it.
No, sir. That's a good question. Let me clarify that. The Wildwood facility will be used exactly as it is now.
As it's constructed now?
Yes, with minor modifications for security and safety codes. As will the Goose Bay facility. It's a two-story wooden barracks building, but we will develop it as is to be utilized. This facility would be for any necessary new construction. For example, our long-term maximum security facility would be using a series of these housing units, about 10 of them. So that any new construction that's needed anywhere in the state from now on for the purposes of incarcerating people, this is the design that we can use.
But there's no way right now that you can use this type of a layout on the present facilities that we had talked about at Wildwood or Goose Bay.
Yes, there is. Yes, we can build this building, for example. As a matter of fact, at Wildwood...
I'm talking about with the facilities that's existing there now. I thought that was part of the reason we were looking at it, because we had some buildings there now, and we were going to modify them to work at it. But right here, I see new construction completely from the ground up.
Yes, sir. This is primarily for the sewer facility, the maximum
security. Okay, that's what I want to get. I'm looking at Wildwood here, and I probably see Goose Bay here in a minute, so thank you.
I'm sorry. I see what you're saying. This is merely an early label. We used Wildwood as the point to develop the prototype.
Okay. Senator Halpin?
Yeah, what are some of the dimensions there? What are the cell dimensions? What are the day room dimensions? What are some of the numbers that go along with that?
These cells are 80 square feet, each cell.
Is it 8 by 10?
Roughly, yes. It depends on the type of building construction. For example, we set this up so that bids can be taken on slide-in steel units, or we can also use concrete block poured in place, tilt-up walls, steel walls, anything. But our estimates are that the slide-in cells will be much less costly. But they are 80 square feet. They do have an exterior window, small slotted window, and can crank open a little bit for air, but it's not the kind of thing a male body can get through. It has skylights to bring in daylight overhead. I don't know the dimension here, but we are assured that this exceeds, to some degree, the American Correctional Association standards, even if in the future these cells would have to be double bunked. So there's a flexibility in here to answer your question earlier, Mr. Chairman, that if and when it's necessary, this facility could be expanded, just as we've done at Cook Inlet. We've doubled the capacity of the Cook Inlet pretrial facility in Anchorage simply by double bunking.
Yeah, just to follow up, when you mentioned the American Society of Corrections, how does that compare, that square footage compared to the 30,000? Do we have a higher standard we have to meet, or what are we going to get out of that?
Well, Clary hasn't determined any square footage. That's one of the issues in the case. The American Correctional Association recommends that on single cells they'd be approximately 70 square feet, 80 square feet for those held in maximum security detention. So our rationale was that since we can reduce the cost of these cells from the beginning, if we make them at the 80 square foot level as opposed to 100 or less, know, 65, 60 square feet. We've got tremendous flexibility from here on, and
well,
we're going to have
a problem. Would this facility satisfy the claims of the petitioners in Cleary if the state loses Cleary?
We think it will. Well, I'm most certain that the physical plant here will exceed.
That's what I mean. I mean, you wouldn't have a situation where we go ahead with this and then the court second guesses us and says you didn't have large enough cells or you didn't have other physical amenities that you should, that...
Yes, we anticipate that this will meet all those standards. By the way, I'm to testify Thursday in the Cleary case, and I will be presenting the same charge, same description to the court in this trial. I have very serious doubts that the court would find fault with the design.
But even though you find this is economical, we still are talking about, I mean, it's still costly. It's still part of a $30 million tab for housing 300 prisoners, more or less.
Well, we've been able to accomplish a couple of other things, as well as what we think is a good design. One of those is that by combining our maximum security, what was formerly planned as a separate maximum security institution, with what was known as the Anchorage Replacement Facility, we can move to 700 beds, and we can save about $8 million in just capital construction by putting the two facilities together. I'll come back to this later. I know Dr. Copas didn't agree that we should have that large facility, but if I might, I'll move along here and show you how that can be operated very efficiently.
Is this the Seward facility or the Cook Inlet facility?
This is Seward.
Seward facility.
This is just a view of the exterior of the housing unit showing how the hands I do when you look, you know, through the window. This is the interior view as it might be seen from the control room in the center of this housing unit. You can see that it'll be very Spartan interior, nothing fancy. It'll be very durable, a lot of steel and masonry work. But it shows the day room space of the two levels. Then to the concept of the entire institution, this is not an architectural drawing, but a functional design showing how these housing units might be built in relationship to the main spine, the core facility. For example, we have all medium security housing over here, and in our design at Seward, we're talking about roughly 400 inmates that would be housed in medium security here, and 300 on this side. That those numbers are rough, but the maximum security housing units here, and a split between maximum and mental health housing, and one whole unit for mental health housing here. The dark line represents the area of interaction from these high security inmates. In other words, they had minimal use of the entire facility, but they would have the same kinds of education and recreation and work opportunities. It's just that they would be isolated. This institution, in other words, can be built on one piece of ground, but managed as two separate institutions. In fact, the housing unit design that we've come up with, you can actually operate and supervise these housing units as separate institutions.
Well, so the medium security prisoner would not be exposed to the maximum security.
That's correct.
Even for dining or theater or whatever.
That's correct. We've done away with separate dining entirely. We remove housing hot carts to the housing units where they'd be fed into day rooms. The key to this whole thing is control. You see that any one quarter of this, there's only 16 inmates here. So it's relatively easy to control the behavior and movement of 16 inmates. Now, they can move in and out of there, but only with a correctional officer's approval and pushing of buttons to allow them entry and access.
And what about outdoor space? Do they commingle like Bogart and Jimmy Cagney in the outdoor place and talk about their escapes while they're waiting for softball practice?
No, Mr. Chairman, they would also be separate.
I have cable television tonight.
This is just a rendering at this point, but it gives you a little bit of a doubt of how they would relate. And what we would have are these spaces between housing units, but again, at the maximum security end, would be isolated. They would not have free access and intermingling with the medium security units. This is representing industries.
Senator Moss, one question. Each one of those units that we're looking at then has roughly 64 people.
Yes. We've run by the Director of Corrections for Texas, and his first opinion was that these housing units should be larger. They should be about 100 people.
and they could be increased to house that. And the more he thought about it, this is a man who runs one of the largest systems in the nation, the more he thought about it, he saw that it made very good sense to keep the unit smaller. The other point I forgot to mention was that in Nome, we have the funds to build one of these facilities in Nome, one of the housing units. Our estimate of cost, by the way, to build this building for 64 people is about $3.6 million. Very inexpensive by comparison to any traditional mechanism. But in Nome, we plan to use space for 48 inmates and use the last one for administrative space. That is, unless we get approval from the legislature for the administrative space separately.
How much of this work is done in-state? In terms of the job creating or labor intensivity of this design as compared to the traditional mode of construction?
Well, except for specialized equipment, which has to be shipped in from elsewhere, there isn't any reason why most of this won't be fabricated right here in state. It would be no different than any other building. First, there was criticism and comment that steel cells would be fabricated in Chicago or California, yeah. So on. We, in talking with at least one of those manufacturers, they are convinced that they can economically fabricate those cells in-state.
Senator Alfred Pershman.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind when I look at that is the amount of exterior area for heating in Alaskan climates. It looks phenomenally expensive to heat that thing. Now, if it's not going to be heated, that's another question, but I expect it will be heated to within 2 degrees of the optimum temperature, according to Clary, if that keeps going. The second question is a different subject, but this is all the phase one engineering?
Yes.
Okay, now, you just canceled the phase two engineering and are going to go from the phase one engineering to basically design build contract? Is
yes,
that what you're looking
right.
at? And that's obviously going to be a bid package contract?
Well, I assume I'll have to rely on our DOT friends to tell us, but I assume that that's highly true, yes.
Because there was some question that it was a negotiated contract originally without a bid, apparently, or something. I don't know.
Well, no. We went through a very long and tedious, methodically managed selection process for the second phase, that is to complete this design, get it to bid-ready specification stage. There'd be some 400 sheets of drawings, for example. That has yet to be completed. But in spite of our best efforts, there were grievances from some of the losers, I guess you would call them, in the process. And we've determined that right or wrong, that is, the grievances, whether correct or not, would cost us time, which is desperately needed right now in order to complete the project. We have determined, and it's interesting that even there were 12 bidders, or 12 people who submitted statements of qualifications and interest on this project. Most of them commented that, in their opinion, 85 to 90% of the design part of the project was completed anyway by this firm. So the state got more than its money's worth if we can trust the 11 other people who were not awarded the contract. So I take that as a compliment. In terms of heating these, there is that question, and we've dealt with it and struggled with it and so on. It's very similar to the Eagle River facility or Highland Mountain facility in that there are separate housing units. And this complex, each of these buildings would have its own utilities, which essentially are housed up over the control room, their own furnaces, for example. So controlling temperatures and so on are easier. You are correct, however, more external surfaces could add somewhat to the construction cost as well as to the potential for heating costs that's being higher. We're convinced, though, that with the insulating packages and so on, heating these facilities would be much less costly than any of our existing facilities. So we've got great efficiencies here from this engineering work.
Yeah. Is there some reason that the modules have to be separated? I mean, you got basically a bunch of building blocks, and that's one way to put those building blocks together. It would seem that you could also save some energy costs if the building blocks were, in fact, all tied together.
Yes, Senator, that is another option. They can, in fact, be tied together. The problem is that from a management perspective in a high security institution, it's not good to tie them together. In other words, we could do as traditionally, build an L-shaped building or a long building or even take a series of these and join them together. But as long as you have communication and movement potential between the buildings, you've defeated the purpose in control, that is in a security environment. Again, it's a growth and evolutionary process, if you will, from what we've learned at the Highland Mountain facility at Eagle River, as well as the Cook Inlet facility. The Cook Inlet is all in one building, and there's tremendous long corridor down through the building, but they also have this sort of day room cell configuration. So what we've done is taken the best ideas that we've gathered through experience and put them together to come up with this design.
And as you said, this is the sewer to...
Yes.
Yes. Now, would you, as you go into the future and you're talking to adding, assuming that the legislature and the governor don't resolve the question of the population growth and we add 300 a year, would those additional people be housed at Seward or at Anderson or Sutton or Whittier, or where would they be?
I think we've got an obligation that to continue to adjust with what we've got. We cannot afford to build new correctional centers. This will be the first new correctional center from the ground up, as you suggested, the whole high security inmates that the state has ever built. If there's going to be future expansion, we're going to have to expand each of our existing plants as best we can.
Let me ask you about that. I hope this isn't too much of an interruption to you.
No, that's correct.
You remember that I think last year the Senate passed its bill on the location of prison facilities, recommending the Palmer Sutton area, and then if a second facility was necessary, Anderson.
Yes.
And I think that went the way of all flesh in the House of Representatives. But I think that represented something of a viewpoint that perhaps it was in the public interest to have different sites. And I suppose also politically to allow different communities to participate in what is actually, if you want to put it that way, a state-generated industry, at least those that wanted it. But as far as you're concerned, and some states do that. I'm told North Carolina is an example where they believe that for control reasons, as you've indicated, and probably for political reasons, that there should be a scattering of sites around the state of North Carolina. But anyway, that's not the philosophy that you're guided by in terms of the Alaska situation.
Well, no. I wouldn't want to leave you with that conception. In fact, historically, Alaska has chosen to develop small regional correctional centers and has done that throughout two institutions in Southeast, one in Fairbanks, one in Elm, and so on. And we are continuing that process. In effect, though, we've just added a second facility to the Matanuska borough, and we're, if Seward comes to pass, we will have added two correctional facilities to the Kenai borough where none existed before. And it is possible we will be opening, for example, a new state-operated facility in Bethel. We will be replacing the one in Nome. It's still an old territorial jail. So we will have this concept of regionalized correctional centers in place.
Well, you will be at Goose Bay for the misdemeanors.
Yes.
But you don't anticipate being at Palmer Sutton even in 1988 or in 1990, is that fair to say?
Not with a new facility. We would expand what we have there for that class of inmates, if necessary.
And you might expand at Fairbanks, but not in Anderson, is that correct?
That's correct. One of the difficulties in site selection is not only public acceptance, but there has to be the logistical support for a facility. Obviously, we depend on the external community to a great deal, medical services, fire life safety issues, clergy, their education. There's a whole list of resources which we need from the local community. So where there are no resources, it makes it very difficult and mostly very costly.
You described to me when we were in Baltimore together the campus location at Seward, which impressed me quite a great deal. Would you like to just say a word about the natural boundaries or configurations at Seward?
Yes, there's a unique setting there at Seward. The site is actually a 4th of July creek, which is directly across the bay from the city of Seward. And there is a paved road already to the site. The
site is fronted by Seward's developing industrial park, so that we will have approximately 335 acres, which is butted up against the base of two very large mountains. In front of that, immediately, about a couple hundred yards away, will be Seward's industrial park, which they are at work on now, and then Resurrection Day itself. So any breach of security at this facility would require that the individual be either a mountain goat or a very good swimmer, because there is no other way in or out. It probably is the next best site to an island location in terms of escape, successful escape, that is, because that one road access controls all movement in and out of the site.
Senator Moss?
Yeah, one thing, I just had to take issue with you, but you only build where there are things that you need. It seems to me like that something like this would help create the proliferation of things that we need in the state. I don't see you doing anything north of the Alaska Range for the interior in any of this stuff. I also noticed that the Goose Bay people, they don't want nothing to do with it, and yet you're going to shove something at them. The general public, they did not want it in the first place in Goose Bay, but apparently you're going to do it anyway. But even with something like this, we have people in Anderson, for example, had a special election that asked for a prison facility. Certain people, I'm getting messages from them, we don't want nothing to do with it. Goose Bay people in Matanuska Valley, we don't want nothing to do with it.
Yes, Senator, that's correct. I attended, I don't know how many public hearings from Haines to all over South Central Alaska at least. Your first point about expanding correctional activities in the interior and north, we do have plans right now on the board to build this replacement facility at Nome. We have just completed a 50-bed expansion at Fairmont.
Not the interior.
All right. I'll concede that. We have just completed expansion in the Fairbanks Correctional Center. We have plans that we would like to put up a Butler-type building for prison industries at that facility. And it is possible that we're going to have to do some modifications to the dining room and food storage area, which would mean additional construction at Fairbanks. So for several years, we've been expanding that Fairbanks Correctional Center. And I expect that as the need continues, as I said earlier, the growth area in the future beyond this building would have to be modifications to existing facilities.
A couple other questions, Mr. Chairman. Yes, sir. One of them has to do with the actual construction. I like this business here. It looks to me like you've got some units that you're going to construct within the state. Don't you have a lot of shops already within your system that can do welding or metalwork such as you're going to need on these modules within the correctional system itself? It seems to me like it would be logical that at this time we might consider the utilization of your prison force as a workforce to help construct some of this, to cut down this tremendous cost that we're looking at.
Yes, Senator, I agree with you wholeheartedly. There is a problem, however, especially on new construction, and that is that we have already some indications from the labor movement in Alaska that they don't want to lose put private sector folks out of jobs unless there is some special mechanism developed for inmate labor. Other states do have that. For example, in Texas, inmates have built entire institutions.
Well, it seems to me like that this ties right in, if I may continue.
Yes, please.
It seems to me that this ties right in with the so-called rehabilitation of these prisoners. One of the main items that we're trying to do now, if we don't want them back in there, we don't want to keep them in there from here on out. We need to rehabilitate them. One of the best ways I know how to rehabilitate somebody, to give them something to do, and if they don't know how to do it in the first place, teach them how to do it. I'm hoping that in the construction of these facilities, even the new facilities, that you consider the utilization of your prison force, your prison inmates, in these plans for rehabilitation as much as anything else. I've heard some problems maybe generated on the rehabilitation course and stuff, which we'll get into, I'm sure, as we work through this thing. But it seems to me like you've got a golden opportunity here right now to rehabilitate people, and when they do get out, they got a trade perhaps when they go out.
I agree, Senator. I would hope that I could get enough support that we could implement exactly that kind of approach. I would like nothing better. I would love to have every inmate that we've got who's sentenced, at least, be actively employed while he's serving his sentence. And that is possible. It is done elsewhere, and we can do it, but it's difficult.
Well, If I may, one more comment, Mr. Chairman. These prisoners, if you do have them working, of course, they're going to be paid a stipend of some sort. Hopefully someday we'll have some kind of regulation on the boat to utilize part of that to make sure they have their families out bothering them, plus maybe even payments to the victims that they're in that or abused or whatever.
I agree, Senator. We have a restitution law on the books now, which the judiciary has not been able to fully utilize. The legislature last year granted me authority to hire a couple of accounting-type positions, which just this month now will be authorized, so I can hire those people. We want to set up for the judiciary a restitution component so that when people, especially those committing property crimes, can reimburse the victim of the crime at least partially, which is better than nothing now, and perhaps the state make a contribution. And that's also being done, has been done since the 1100s, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any way that we can make a prisoner work if he doesn't want to work, or is that one of the things that we can't do under Clary and all the other constitutional provisions?
We have a statute under prison industries legislation, Senator Alford, that permits us to, I'll use the term, to force inmates to work. There is always a potential an inmate would not be willing to cooperate, but we do have the statutory authority to put inmates to work.
Is that statutory authority in conflict with anything in the current Clary Ryan issues?
No, there isn't any conflict there. As a matter of fact, one of our strongest points that we're trying to make with the court is that we are trying to put as many inmates to work as possible. And in the last 12 months, we've made some very substantial progress. We've had inmates clearing trails up here at Eagle Crest. We've had them doing the same thing at Hatcher Pass and Palmer. We've had them, they're right now repairing state cars for the Department of Transportation at Palmer. They're making road signs in the Mattoon Borough. There's a variety of activities, but it's not enough. We need much more. That's why I need help.
The denial of work opportunities is an agreement of the plaintiffs.
Yes, that's correct.
Let me ask you specifically. Let me ask you about Whittier. Do you see any prospect for retrofitting the structures in Whittier for a future medium or minimum security facility, or maximum? I think that would be more difficult. I know that's been considered and rejected now, but I'm looking at trying to look ahead a decade or so.
Yes. Last year, the legislature, I believe Representative Bennettsworth, introduced a bill for the Buckner Building at Whittier.
I think a committee of the House has been moving a bill on that subject just in the last week, so this is a timely issue, I think.
Yes, that's correct. I testified last year before the House Finance Committee, where the prime sponsor was, and I testified just a week ago in House Hess, and Representative Furness presented that bill. I testified against it on both occasions. I was able to convince the representatives last year that it was not a good idea. I've attempted to convince the representatives this year that it's not a good idea. In fact, there's a decade of records going back where every predecessor I can name has been adamantly opposed to it. The Department of Transportation has evaluated it. Their evaluation in 1982 indicated that it would cost $42 million to bring that building up to code and re-roof it, put in utilities and so on, and another $20 million to put it into shape for correctional purposes. The estimates now before the House indicate that $25 million would make it into a turnkey operation within 6 months. I'm not an engineer, so I'm speaking beyond my qualifications, but I doubt seriously that building could be made ready in less than 2 years, and it would cost substantially more than $25 million.
But what was the operator or owner of the facility willing to offer that price, though, and say he would take the company would take the risk if there was a cost overrun?
That's my understanding.
So would that be a state's problem or the operator's problem if, in fact, his estimate is?
Well, I assume that would be the operator's problem, but I also assume that he probably would not be able to take that risk unless the state would furnish some assurance that they were willing to purchase or lease it from him. Beyond that, though, if I might, the Whittier location is a very poor one because for the same reason that other locations are poor, the logistical support doesn't exist. In fact, the citizens of Whittier are adamantly opposed to it, both as represented in telegrams I received from them last year and in their presence here last week.
Did they come and testify against the bill in the House last week?
They didn't testify, but they were present in the room, and I understand that they were busy talking to various legislators about their opposition. And however, for example, when there's a state trooper, it is at Girdwood. There's nothing but a small volunteer fire department. There's no school system. There's no medical service or medications of any kind in Whittier. There's very little potential for housing, the staff that would be required for a facility of that size. Ironically, it's the largest building in all of Alaska. It will never fall down. It's a huge concrete fortress. It even has expansion joints in it in case of earthquake or temperature change. It's a very impressive building. But I doubt seriously that it would work well as an alternative for correctional operations, mainly because it would be so difficult to get to and get out of. For example, in a high-security facility such as this one, while we can develop very secure perimeters, the problems in maximum security facilities become internal. Hostage situations and riots and so on internal to the institution are where the problems develop. So you must have access to outside help. Off-duty staff, troopers, I hope this never happens in Alaska, but National Guard and so on, as has happened in other states. Fire suppression teams and so on, emergency teams of all sorts have to be available. At Whittier, because of its tunnel location and the inability to fly in and out of there and so on, makes it very inappropriate.
I don't want to belabor that, but as I understand, there's one thing. As I understood it, the sponsors of the bill contemplate that the tunnel might be converted to road traffic and or that the probably state-operated railroad would be available to bring people
If those events were to occur, Mr. Chairman, I think that it would change to some degree the acceptability of the Whittier site. But I would be hesitant to say that we should build that if these other things happen. I'd like to make it clear I realize in testifying in opposition to the Whittier plan, there's always the potential that it will pass through the legislature. And if that happens, I would be required to refurbish it and operate it. And
we have to do so.
That's correct. But we would do so if that's, we'll carry out legislative intent or direction. But I think professionally, I should tell you that it's, in my opinion, not a good idea.
Go ahead, Roger, with anything else you wanted to cover?
Just a few other items. The Ketchikan Correctional Center opened in June of 83, just a few months ago, and houses 50 inmates. I just received a call about 2 weeks ago from Presiding Judge Tom Schultz of the southeastern area here, and he is requesting that we develop temporary portable units adjacent to that brand new facility because he has 28 prisoners awaiting jail space. So we've taken steps to try to move in portable units as a temporary measure, but clearly we would like to build what we call the Palmer Medium model, and we think, to answer Senator Moss's opinion, that could be built by inmate labor because its traditional construction methods would frame buildings. The Wildwood Correctional Center opened in October of 83, was housing 56 inmates. They're doing renovations and repair of the facility. It now has 70 inmates in it. It will, in the next few months, hold 200. We opened a new wing in Fairbanks in November, housing an additional 40. There'll be a new section that's opening right now, as a matter of fact, at the Juneau Correctional Center and single security units. So that's going on. The Wildwood will be expanded. The Bethel Center will be online in September. Cook Inlet pretrial facility addition will be completed next December. We hope to have Nome online sometime into next year, and Goose Bay. Lastly, with an old municipal. So with that as an overview in terms of our housing capacities and problems, and I'd be happy to address the COPAS report or any other issues you might have.
Thank you. Well, I think one thing in that report that you promised to address had to do with the issue of correction salaries versus public safety salaries.
So I understand that at least one legislator suggested that rather than raising correctional salaries, that other law enforcement officer salaries might be lowered. I wouldn't propose that either. But there is a disparity between the two groups of types of professions, if you will. However, that's not my highest priority. Adequate staffing, adequate numbers of staffing is what's most essential at this time. things that it has done in setting up a sort of pseudo-department is created additional career enhancement opportunities. There is now the opportunity for bright, hardworking, motivated people to move on up a ladder which wasn't there before. So we have already expanded the opportunities for people to advance. Also with the fact that we're expanding our populations, and in some cases, new types of correctional positions, for example, mental health workers, bringing more people of varied types into the system creates additional opportunities. I think the frustration felt by many correctional officers has to do with the previous, if not perception, perhaps in fact, dead-end kinds of jobs. It is possible, as COPAS recommends, that we expand to another one or two layers of correctional officers, and that's possible, but we're not pursuing that right now.
Yes.
One of the statements in the COPAS report was that most of the agreements in the Clary settlement were not constitutionally mandated to many degrees. I wonder where we are as far as that case is concerned, and take us forward from when the transition team initially picked up from the previous administration, where we are right now, what's been signed off, what hasn't, what kind of possibilities do we have in some of the areas that appear to be ridiculous, such as food temperature monitoring, room temperatures, and the ridiculous things that are going to cost us $1 million a year, Fairbanks, if his report's right, and that kind of number in other institutions as well.
Well, there are some very real problems, both with the report and the perceptions that people have about the cost of the Cleary case. The most direct costs are related to the creating of some positions as Cleary compliance monitors, and there will be one of those positions in each institution. And we have made substantial progress in all of our institutions setting them up, and in some we're using computers to help the individual monitor these cases. But I read where it could cost $7,000 a month, potentially, just to check temperatures in the Fairbanks institution. That, unfortunately, is not correct. Just as you would check the temperature in your own home, it's very clear that the temperature need only be checked when there is an apparent problem, and then not throughout the entire institution. So just logic would tell us that that's a very simple matter to deal with. In terms of cost, we presented to the legislature last year approximately $335,000 to pay for those compliance monitors and immediate things which are related to Cleary partial settlement. The other items that are in this case, such as increased educational opportunities, increased work opportunities, increased so on, should, in my opinion, be done in any case. So they are not, in my mind, related directly to the Cleary settlement. Our estimates last year were that if we settled the case in total, it would cost the state somewhere near $8 million. We elected not to go that route. We are fighting the case. Maybe I should tell you that there are two events currently in the hopper in regard to this case. First, we have appealed to the Supreme Court on an issue in regard to overcrowding. That issue has not been heard yet by the court, but should they rule in our favor, there is a chance that the entire partial settlement could be done away with. It's relatively complex. I'm not sure what I should discuss at this point because it is in trial. Secondly, we asked last Thursday for a directed verdict so that the court, if the court agrees, would throw out most of the issues in the case and leave only the overcrowding and the rehabilitation program issues.
Throw out most of the issues in the case, not the issues that have already been stipulated to.
No.
I mean, haven't we already agreed to a whole bunch of conditions?
In some respects, yes, but that agreement, in my opinion, is now in jeopardy because we feel the court has erred. We are asking the Supreme Court to rule on that. And if the Supreme Court agrees with us, then potentially the partial settlement agreement could be opened back up again.
See, the whole problem I have from the legislative perspective is your opening statement and direct quote should, in my opinion, be done in any case. If from the executive branch we're going forward with things that should be done, and it is the executive branch that is doing the negotiating, then I have substantial problems in what input the legislature will have after the fact on funding an outside deal between executives. back to the legislature, when there's a strong feeling apparent around here that the Clary settlement may not be in the state's best interest.
I appreciate that, Senator Alford, and Mr. Chairman, and I should make it very clear that last year when I took office, we had substantial numbers of hearings before legislative committees and kept them informed as to precisely everything happening in the Clary case. I can't recount those hearings now, but the AG's office and myself represented before numerous hearings. We explained everything in that budget. And the legislature either agreed or disagreed, but Dr. Copas, I'm afraid, is in error when he states that the legislature has not been involved in that process. That is untrue.
Well, wait a minute. I sat in as a member of the Finance Committee in some discussions about the case in which you participated and representative of the Department of Law. And I think it's a question, in a way, of being informed but not consulted, because I make that distinction because it was, and it's not anybody's fault, I think, but the legislature cannot negotiate this matter with counsel for the petitioners, and we do not have counsel before the bench. And from time to time, we have reports that we think the case will go in this direction or that direction in the case, and the courts may probably go so and so. If we don't fund it, we're going to have the judicial branch take over the courts and take over the prisons, and you know, we don't want that. So it is that is the relationship. We've been informed, but I don't think there's been an active process of consultation because we don't have the, I must say, expertise, staff, or knowledge of the intricacies to be very effective in consulting. We wouldn't contribute much except to say we don't like it or that's something we will never find the money for, but that's the only kind of parameters we can.
I've always felt off the cuff that we should put corrections in the courts together and then we can argue about the budget all the same time.
But in the Copas report, getting apart from the dollars, his findings were that the Clary matter has had very adverse effects on morale of correctional officers and increased anxieties about assaults and that type of thing. Do you concur or not?
I'm afraid, Mr. Chairman, I do not concur. For one thing, that piece of research evaluated primarily one institution, and had the researcher bothered to go to visit in depth, as in depth, the other institutions, 6th and C in downtown Anchorage, for example, is a prime example. That institution is also under court order from a previous case. It is one of the most efficient, cleanest operating, highest morale institutions we have in the state. The Cook Inlet facility, which is a direct result of the Clary case in terms of compliance monitoring and so on, is running much more efficiently because, in my opinion, of this case. Now, I hope you won't misunderstand me. I'm not soliciting court cases and lawsuits. Nevertheless, there has been a positive impact on the management of several of our facilities as a result of this litigation. And what Dr. Copas found in Fairbanks was not only a result of the Clary case, but the fact we have an administrative transition taking place there, which is a little unsettling. And also at the time that Dr. Copas evaluated that institution, the Clary implementation, if you will, was new to that institution. And I'm predicting that in a very short time, a matter of a few months, that institution will be humming along and probably working better than it ever has.
John, do you have any other questions?
What about the data processing thing that Copas?
Yes, I agree with him there. I believe that we've made very substantial progress in our data processing capability in just the last 12 months. For several years, corrections had tried to get this offender-based correctional information system off the ground and was unable to do so for a variety of reasons. We were able to hire a couple of very good people who had some knowledge and experience with those systems. They have the system up and running now, and I can tell you on a daily basis how many inmates we have in a variety of categories, how many are on furloughs, programs of all sorts, and so on. So it's a very valuable management tool.
Yeah, I just going to ask a question. You had a really interesting chart up there, pie chart, a little earlier, that had to do with the types of prisoners, the misdemeanor prisoners and the felons. I'm just wondering,
On the felons, for example, it looks like we got 85% of them are felonious type folks. Now, some of those felons just got a year's time to serve, some about 100 years, or what? In other words, it would be interesting to know what the breakdown is on that 85% is what I'm getting at.
Yes.
How long can we expect to have that 85% in prison, in a sense? I guess that's what I'm asking. The misdemeanor, what are they, 1 to 5 or something like that?
Generally less than 1 year.
Okay. And the 85% is...
A year and over. The average being somewhere in the neighborhood of 24 months, but climbing. That is the average is dangerous, I know, but the average felon is serving somewhere in excess of 2 years now, and it's going up. See, one of the reasons for this, Senator Moss, is that there are various mandatory sentencing provisions now. Determinate sentencing, presumptive sentencing, they all mean roughly the same sort of thing, in that judges have far less discretion than they used to have. And so for sexual offenses, for example, we now have 280 sexual offenders in our system, whereas a few years ago there were many, many fewer. Now, some of that is a direct result of new laws, new statutes, but there are many of those offenses which carry determinate sentencing, mandatory sentencing. The judge, for example, in a what would formerly be a lewd lascivious case, involving a minor and an adult, now must sentence an individual found guilty to something like 8 years. That's mandatory. There's no flexibility.
Well, so that of the 1,334, 280 would be sex offenders?
Yes. Actually, that number should be about 1,700, the total number.
Yeah, the total number, felony misdemeanor.
Yes.
1,334 is just the felonies.
Yes. But that number is slightly wrong, too. It's gone up.
Okay, but so there's 280... How many felons are you now controlling? 1,500?
Yes.
Are the 280 part of that group, or do they include misdemeanors in for sex offenses?
No, these are primarily felons.
Now, because the administration, I think, has legislation in the hopper to provide for releases of people to keep prison populations stabilized.
Yes, we have an emergency commutation plan.
Where is that bill now? Do you know?
Senate Finance.
Okay. Do you have any? Is the administration contemplating any other proposals to modify our sentencing laws? To for example, as to restore a quantum of discretion to trial judges in such matters as you've described.
Those bills, Mr. Chairman, would come from the Department of Law, and I'm not aware of any. There is, I believe it's Bill 167, which is a kind of an omnibus correctional revision, which could adjust good time provisions. There's also a parole bill. All right, well, that will be a piece of legislation to be introduced, which will retain the parole board.
My memory of the conference we attended was that the science or art of predicting who will be recidivist and who will be dangerous if released or paroled is making some advances. In other words, some people contend that you can be more predictive than you used to think. Do you have any feeling for that as to how we might apply that in Alaska to stop the lying going off the boards as far as our prison population is concerned?
Well, there's a number of things that can be done lot more exploration, but it does seem to me that we do have better risk assessment scales now. They've been developed and tried in other states. We would have to develop our own because our population is somewhat different. But we can do risk assessments on potential offender or offenders accused of crimes and assess them for the court. We can also do risk assessments for those people sent to us by the court. Essentially, the corrections is like a bathtub full of water, and you either control the amount of water going into the bathtub or the outflow, that is, the drain. If you keep the flow coming in or increase it, and you keep that drain stopped or slow it down, you must get a bigger bathtub. Very simply, that's the case. But there are adjustments that can be made.
What you put in the bathtub should come out cleaner.
That's true. We can take a number of steps, though. Less hazardous offenders, those not convicted of assaults or person-to-person kinds of crimes, can be housed in less secure housing, less expensive housing, such as Wildwood, such as Goose Bay. And we can reserve our very expensive, high-cost space for the serious felony offender. It costs roughly $3 a day, $3 a person, to supervise someone on probation or parole. It costs about $45 a day to house them in a halfway house or community treatment center. It costs about $75 a day on average to keep them in a full-scale jail. So it's very expensive. And we can classify prisoners. They don't all have to go to hardcore, what we call hard bed space. Some of those people can go to soft bed space.
Senator Hubbard? Just briefly with regard to that, the only thing that I would say is that I would hope that anyone that finally gets through the judiciary and through the police system and all the other obstacles at least sees what hard bed space is like, particularly younger felons, even if only for a 30-day period, to realize the value of the programs and sometimes just give them a serious look at it. The other thing, I think, you know, there probably is legislative support to look at alternatives for one class of those people. I don't think there's a lot of support, at least not for me, in terms of the felons that did something that was either personal or violent. However, there's got to be a percentage in there that committed crimes that were non-personal, in the sense of not burglary in a dwelling, but burglary in a warehouse, and non-violent, and in the sense of possibly forgery or something else. And in that area, perhaps double or triple restitution with very heavy fines and a 30-day sentence in hard bed space may be much more effective than a 3-year sentence at $35,000 a year cost to the state.
Well, I think, Senator Alford, that those suggestions are important. There is a term called shock probation, where an individual, particularly a first offender, but others too, can be sent to jail for 30 days, 6 months, whatever, and then let out on probation supervision for the remainder of that sentence. That works very well. Restitution can be ordered so that the man, whether he's in prison or out, can work and earn money to pay back the victim and or the state, at least for the partial cost of the crime. That also is possible.
Well, the key for us being able to, if that's a way that we can help, I think that's a way that you don't run into a philosophical fight with the legislature over determinate sentencing, minimum sentencing, all the other things. If you can come back with a number that represents the portion of that population that fits the category of nonviolent, non-personal, I think you've got a lot better chance of getting support for legislative action to relieve overcrowding in that way than to give the governor blanket authority to commute sentences regardless of what those sentences are.
But we also have the problem that just as a matter of demographics, a lot of offenses, a high proportion of certain kinds of offenses are committed by people in their teens or early 20s, and yet we keep people incarcerated maybe until they're 40 years old or 35 years old, when many of them would be dropouts anyway from violent crime.
Yes, I hope I don't offend, Mr. Chairman, but as it came out at a conference that we attended in Baltimore, the National Institute of Justice put together, it was said repeatedly that one of the basic problems that we're faced with in all 50 states is that the legislature passes laws which are often popular with the constituents, and to be tough on crime and criminals is important, and it's acceptable to the public. However, it's also that same legislature that approves additional housing for correctional space, and that's much, much more difficult, hence the dilemma we're faced with. Now, if what we're trying to do in this agency is for every bill that comes up that has criminal penalties attached to it, we're trying to do responsible fiscal notes that would indicate as clearly as we can the cost of implementing that bill. So we'll try to assist as best we can in letting the legislature know what our estimates of the costs of these bills will be.
Mr. Endell, we were contacted by a representative of the Salvation Army who has an interest in non-residential programs for supervising probation-like people and misdemeanors. Is there, and we were told that in Florida there is such a program where I think it is the Salvation Army that operates such a program for the state under a contract. Are you looking at such a system now of possibly contracting? I'm not sure it's really your function, as a matter of fact. I don't know who once
when people are not in custody, whose responsibility are they? Hess's or the agency's?
If they're committed for a criminal offense, either probation or incarceration, they are our responsibility. If they're not committed, that's true, they would be some other entity's responsibility, whether it's a municipality or health and social services.
Do you have any proposal from any nonprofit agencies to, on a turnkey basis, take care of a misdemeanor population? Has that been suggested to you, to get them out of the state?
A year ago, I'm sorry, to get them out
of the state? To contract out that function.
Oh, yes. Last year, the Salvation Army and Anchorage made such a proposal. We evaluated it and determined that it was not a terribly efficient proposal.
That's the obstreperous minority. He'll stop at nothing. You say it was not an efficient proposal?
Yes, we determined that the cost of that proposal would be very expensive. We also think, though, that we probably need some statutory assistance, and that we think for less cost, we probably could contract with the private sector to manage at least misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. Right now, the statutes don't appear to give us that authority. We can contract with governments to house prisoners, but it isn't clear that we have that authority to contract with the private sector.
So, in other words, that particular proposal had some defects, but if the statute was changed, you would be open to considering that as an alternative?
Yes.
And you would have to do that, presumably, even if the statute were changed by a competitive bid process. You could negotiate a contract with the Salvation Army.
That would be doubtful, unless possibly they were the only person, but still it would be basically a bid process.
Were there any studies done that indicated that there might be savings to the state in doing that?
There are potential savings, and I mean to emphasize potential savings, because, for example, we've learned in negotiating for medical contracts, for medical services in the Anchorage area, those costs have escalated to the point where we now feel it would cost us less if we had our own state employees to provide medical services. They've tripled in the last year, and the services have increased to some degree, but not significantly. We also think, by the way, that there's a tremendous potential in the prison industries area, and we have a tentative proposal from a major corporation that would create and provide inmate jobs, and we would not have to pay this corporation unless those jobs lasted at least 36 months. So it would be very inexpensive, if any cost at all, to the state, and it would cause inmates to go to work. So we're entertaining that. We want them to be more specific about how they would put that program to work. But essentially, I illustrated this the other day in one of the other committees, that right now, if you call from anywhere in the United States to make a Best Western reservation, your reservation is being taken by an Arizona inmate. That's one example of how private industry comes into the prison system. There are many others.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, I want to thank you for coming and having this informal conversation with you. Appreciate it very much, Roger. And we'll adjourn for me this time.